My name is Jay, and I'm an alcoholic. And welcome. This first slide, we're going to be talking today about the mysticism, and the best way to describe it, I believe, is from this book called Practical Mysticism by a woman by the name of Evelyn Underhill. This book was written in 1914. Evelyn Underhill was the first female lecturer at Oxford. Can you imagine the consciousness of this woman? Anyway, she says, mysticism is the art of union with reality, a capital R being all that is. The mystic is a person who has attained the union in a lesser or greater degree, or who aims at and believes in such attainment. I like to call this talk rocketed, because that's what happens. And what this is it's the mystical journey of Bob and Bill. And this is in their own words. Now, many people say to me, oh, Jay, I love the history. I'm so glad that you're investigating the history and sharing this stuff with me, until I start to say things that contravene how it is they think things were. And I have to tell you that it's been very humbling over the past few years to read the private letters of Bill W. and Dr. Bob and some of the people that they corresponded to, and find out how very wrong I was in many of the things that it is that I thought and said over the previous years. About 85% of what you will hear tonight is directly from them. So, one of the things that I think is fascinating about this movement, what is it that makes AA different? Why is it that we haven't become a religious sect or a cult? And I believe that it has to do with our co-founder's allergy to hierarchy, their philosophical open-mindedness, and their unwillingness to develop a dogma. These were two fearless seekers. Now, most everything I'll be talking about today is referenced in conference-approved literature. And a lot of people come up to me and they say, Jay, what should I read in order to know what they really believed and what they really did? Well, I always say, please, first read the conference-approved literature. Because that first we need to know who it is we say we are before we go sideways looking at a lot of different stuff. Now, one of the things that's very important for some of the younger folks here to understand is that just 75 years ago, alcoholism and drug addiction was a death sentence. And when we take a look at what it was that Bill and Bob actually did to support their spiritual growth and their sobriety, you know, they were not fettered by convention. The miraculous had occurred in their lives. They weren't drinking. And they'd received this solution. And so they weren't fettered with some of the judgment that we may have now. And that's some of the things that I'm going to talk about this evening. Now, this is William James. William James is one I'll be talking about, a lot of people that that were considered, Bill would call, co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill hated that term. In fact, in one of the letters that I read, he said that he would sell his correspondent the title of co-founder for 15 cents. Now, James, in The Varieties of Religious Experience, which is a fabulous, fabulous set of lectures that became a book that was one of the great books of the last century, the turn of the last century. He said that while the revelations of the mystic hold true for the mystic, they only hold true for the mystic. They are certainly ideas to be considered, but can claim no hold on truth without personal experience. Now, this weekend, we will be hearing the personal experiences from some of the most fabulous, engaged, and involved members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And these wonderful presenters will be talking about their own experience of the step. But we can't take their experience. We have to go and get our own. And that is the difference between Alcoholics Anonymous and just about any other spiritual movement, because we have to consider what people's experience is, but we have to go and get our own. Now that we have a lot of fabulous resources in this fellowship, one of which is a guy by the name of Mel B., and he lives in Toledo, Ohio. And Mel sings very flatly. And in 1956, he wrote a letter. He met Bill at Founders Day, and he wrote Bill a letter. And Bill sent back a beautiful, beautiful letter to Mel. And in it, he said to Mel that little by little, I think we shall strip away the mystery from mysticism. He said, indeed, the mystic experience, so-called, is the essence of every AA's transformation, whether he knows it or not. Now, part of the challenge that our co-founders had was that they were deified almost. Bill could never even walk into a room just because of the way he was like as big as Jimmy. You know, I mean, how are you going to miss him, right? Some anonymous guy, right? But he said, because of tendency to exaggerate me as a person and so invite a rather unhealthy dependence at the very time when it is highly necessary that AA's dependence should only be upon God and certainly not upon me. There's a wonderful book called Language of the Heart, which the Grapevine has published. And it's got a lot of the letters that I'll be, some of the letters that I'm referring to. But a lot of the things that I've been privileged to read because of my interest and the time that I've spent, are the second letters. You know how when you first have a conversation with somebody, it's kind of light, and the second time you go a little deeper. And this was a letter that Bill... In Language of the Heart, Bill talks with an Australian about the use of the Lord's Prayer in meetings. And it's a wonderful piece. But then there was a follow-up letter. And in it, Bill writes to Russ. He says, your correspondence has raised memories of the early days. When the AA book was written, this was very much a question in the forefront. None of us, saving one, who was really active in the preparation of that book, were professing Christians. The one man who was naturally urged that we include a great deal more Christian theology in the book than we did. Therefore, the only theological proposition in the book Alcoholics Anonymous is God, a higher power, and God as we understand him. I do not think it imperative that either my theological views nor those of Dr. Bob ever have any appreciable influence on AA. That would only create another competing religion. And of these, we certainly have enough. Thank God. Thank God. So here's where the spiritual journey begins for these guys. When Carl Jung, another fabulous piece of correspondence that's in this book, Language of the Heart, and another resource if you aren't part of it yet, is go on and buy into aagrapevine.org. And there's an archives thing where you can actually read costs about $35 a year. You can read every article that ever was published in the Grapevine. And it's just fascinating and consoling information. And Bill and Carl Jung had some correspondence, and it's some of the deepest philosophy that's available. And when Jung is speaking to Bill about the disease of alcoholism, he's talking about it as a spiritual malady. He doesn't call it a spiritual malady, but then when he's talking about recovery from alcoholism, he says that there are basically three ways that someone can recover. First, by an act of grace, or through personal and honest contact with friends, which I believe Jimmy and the committee and everybody has created this weekend. This weekend is about honest and personal contact with friends. Or through a higher education of the mind beyond the confines of mere rationalism. In this letter that Bill wrote to Mel, he talks about his experience at Towns. In our fifth tradition, it says that every AA group is a spiritual entity. So what I'd like to do is to bring this together as a spiritual entity. If you'd be kind enough, we're just going to do a little minute or two meditation. I'm going to read a little piece that Bill wrote. But I'd just like you to please just close your eyes and take a really deep breath. And then just blow it out. Bill says, in talking about my flash of reality, his experience at Towns Hospital, I often feel to make the point of that every AA that gets the program gets the same thing. If you were to take the sum of your own transformations since you've been in AA and condense that whole business into 6 minutes, you'd see stars too and more. So let's just take a minute and consider the transformations that we've had since we've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you. Bill goes on to say, one further point. With me, the original experience was so prodigious, the preview of destiny so intense, that I've never had any difficulty with any doubt since that time. Even at my worst, and that has often been damn bad. Bill had the classic sudden spiritual experience. And in many of the letters that he wrote, he talks about seeing the fellowship full formed. I don't know if that meant the 40s or the 50s or maybe even to this day. And that this was something that informed his spiritual experience and kept him going through all the things that he experienced, especially those first few years. Part of the reason that I am so excited to share this information with you people is that I believe that Bill and Bob are both trapped in boxes. Bill, because he liked to use himself as a foil, you know, always talking about him being himself as being a promoter and that like. But that was really the first few years. This man was a paragon of compassion. He was fearless when it came to helping drugs. Anybody, I know we can't raise our hand about this in this group because we're very properly sober. But I don't know if you've ever been around where somebody said, well, I'm sponsoring too many people, and I can't stand the pressure. It's too much for me. Bill got literally hundreds of letters every week from people from all over the world who were in various stages of hopelessness, tragedy, and he would answer each and every one of them. And the depth of his compassion is absolutely amazing. The other thing about Bill is his having had both sides. This is a letter that he wrote about not having faith. He said, "I often wish that the never-say-die skeptics, such as I once was, could have their own personal experience. For as believers can be foolishly credulous and absurdly unreasonable, so can the skeptic. All of the problems that we have, or that we think we have, are three-dimensional. The solution is in the fourth. And I believe that as one takes a look at the arc of Bill's life, that really what he kept doing was being a cheerleader, saying, hey, there's another dimension to existence. Come, seek, look, try, do, experiment. Bill talking about Dr. Bob, he says, Dr. Bob was made of better stuff. In his personal life, he always came much closer to spiritual achievement than I ever did. He seemed never to have been victimized by awful conflicts. Though this is not for sure because he was a real stoic. Now, Bob took 17 years to ask Ann to marry him. You think he might have had a little problem communicating? Bill goes on to say, unlike me, he was a vast reader of spiritual and psychic literature. He had a great library of it. By contrast, my own reading has been very sparse. I still have rather relied on observation and conversation. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I know that in my own experience, and whenever I have a friend who's had a conversion experience in any different religious pursuit or philosophical pursuit, they'll come running to you and go, oh, my gosh! I've been reading the Holy Quran, and it's obvious that Bill had a deep relationship with the Prophet Muhammad. I mean, look at it. It's right here. Or, oh my gosh, Bill must have read the Upanishads. It's clear that he was a Hindu. I had a woman the other day. I was speaking at a conference. She came up and she said, how often did Joseph Campbell and Bill Wilson meet? I said they had coffee together every 2 weeks. The thing is that truth is truth. Spiritual truth is spiritual truth. But this co-founder that I loaded a lot of stuff on, saying, well, it's obvious that he got this in the big book from here. Not true. Not true. Now, this is one of those things about what happened as opposed to how maybe I think things should be. Dr. Bob, one time somebody asked me, did Dr. Bob ever do a fifth step? Well, there's nothing in the literature that actually talks about it. And then I found a talk that Bill gave at Founders Day, and it's a great talk, and he talks about Dr. Bob getting sober. He's come back from Atlantic City. He's suffering really bad. They're giving him sauerkraut and tomato juice, and they're giving him barbiturates, and they're giving him booze, and they're trying to taper him up and taper him down, and because Bob's got to give this surgery. And I don't know if everybody here knows, but Bob was a proctologist. These are delicate operations. And so, anyway, Bob's really suffering. I don't know if it was the stewed tomatoes or the sauerkraut, but anyway, he's suffering. And he looks at Bill and he says, you know, he said, I am going to do a thorough house cleaning. He said, I'm going to go through with what it is that we've been talking about. And Bill thinks he's talking about the operation. And he goes, well, yeah. He says, no, I'm one of those damned Yankees who just bottle things up and hang on and can't let go. He said, that's why I drank. Because I wasn't willing to make things right. So he says, and I'm going to get a house cleaning, and you're going to listen. And Bill says, go ahead, fire away. You can't shock me. And so Bob tells him whatever it was that Bob told him. That morning, they go down to the hospital. Bob's sponsor, Bill, has decided that he tapered Bob off just a little too much. So he gives him a bottle of ale and drops a couple of goofballs in it. For those of you who want to know, a goofball is a barbiturate. Of a certain age, they're reds, they're yellows. Tuna, tekna, ting dong. So he drops the goofball in and sends Bob in to do the operation. Fortunately, it was successful, right? But then Bob doesn't come home for hours and hours. Bill starts packing. He's going to leave. Obviously, the guy's gone and gotten loaded. He got through the problem, and now he's gone again. He's on a run. And then Bob shows up. You know, can you imagine them flying at the door? Where have you been? Pre-Al-Anon. And they said, where have you been? And Bob, the great communicator, says, I've been out mending fences. He'd gone out and done his night step. Now, what would you do with someone who'd had a bottle of ale and a couple of goofballs? What would you say, and some stewed sauerkraut? What would you say to them when they came to you and said, I went out and I mended the fences. I'm in. Does it count? Would it count? Thank God it did with Bill. So this next part is about psychic exploration. And this is about Bill and Bob's personal experiences. This is not about your interpretation of what is plausible and what isn't. This is how these guys lived and what happened. This is Smitty and his dad. Many of you had the good pleasure of hearing Smitty, Dr. Bob's son, when he was alive, given those great Al-Anon talks that he gave. And in talking about his dad, he said that his dad was interested in people who claimed to have ESP and other forms of spiritual insight. He felt that in a few distant centuries, the science of the mind would be so developed as to make possible contact between the living and the dead. And again, Smitty had this great thing when he was talking about his dad. He said he remembered when he was 16, it's time for the sex lecture. My dad's a doctor. And the old man takes him upstairs and he's going, I'm going to learn some stuff. His father closes the door and says, sit down, son. Flies transmit disease. Keep yours closed. And leaves. Now, one of the fascinating characters in early Alcoholics Anonymous is this guy by the name of Roland J., not to be confused with Roland H. And he was a person who did a lot of studying about different spiritual faiths and all kinds of things in his search for sobriety. This comes from Clarence S. But he never did stop drinking until he met Dr. Bob. Well, we used to go to Roland's on Sunday night, and he'd call in the spirits. It got spooky after a while, beyond what we should be monkeying with. Doc backed off, too. And one of the, and this stuff is all referenced, much of this stuff is referenced in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. And there's some kind of odd folk wisdom that somehow Bob is this rigid, righteous, locked-down Christian guy. This arc of spiritual investigation I'm talking about is over a 12-year period. He was only with us for 15. So it's not like, you know, this was just a little burp he had. There was a woman by the name of Virginia M., and she had a daughter who was very, very sick. And she came to Bob, and she said, what am I going to do? I'm supposed to take her to Cleveland, and she's supposed to have this exotic operation. And Bob said, well, yeah, we can do that, but maybe you ought to bring her by to see Roland. You know, she'd always have the operation. So what happened is Virginia comes by, brings the kid, talking with Roland and with Bob, and Roland says to her, well, do you believe in spiritualism? Do you believe in spiritual healing? And she goes, well, I don't know. I really don't have any opinion. He said, great. Go to a movie. We don't need any interference here. And so she went off to a film, came back a couple hours later, and her daughter was healed and never had a problem again. And this is the kind of stuff that Bob was involved in helping with, aside from his normal spiritual medical practice. There's a great picture of Sue Smith, and she's talking about the community in Akron. She says that, you know, they were all against the spiritualist thing. Dad got to feel that he was being criticized, that they didn't approve. But I think it was really because they weren't included. They didn't like the fact that Bob was having special meetings with just him and a couple of his friends. So here's Stepping Stones. How many folks here have been to Stepping Stones? And if you haven't been, go. One of the great things that happened just recently is that both Stepping Stones and Dr. Bob's house have become national historical monuments, which bodes very well for the future of the movement, about being able to, yeah, it's cool stuff. So regarding the spiritualist stuff, Bill says, I know to many this subject is suspect or taboo, or just ridiculous. Like most scoffers at prayer, practically always people who are scoffing never tried. The doubters in the field of psychics are mainly those who never really investigated, let alone having any real experience themselves. Among AAs, I've seen most convincing examples of clairvoyance, clairaudience, and the like. Dr. Bob and a group out in Akron had a whole rash of similar experiences. This is the sort of thing which today is held in contempt by both theologians and scientists, lest their several systems of thinking be disturbed. These guys didn't care what people thought. They were following their own hearts. Now, this is the spook group. There's Nell Wing, there's Tom P., there's DeVoe B., there's Bill, and just so you know that they were well supervised, there's Ann B. and Lois, the co-founders of Al-Anon, monitoring the experience, making sure they're doing it correctly. Now, it's really interesting. What happened is that when they got the house at Stepping Stones, after a time they started having these groups of people come by and they would do spiritual investigation together. And they would do what was called table tapping, and they'd use the Ouija board and a bunch of different stuff. And Bill, who'd had the great awakening experience, for 2 years, when it was his turn to be the receiver of the messages, nothing ever came through. And then one day it did. And when it did, it came through with such force that it was going on in his mind for like 2 weeks. He thought he was going to have to go to the hospital. And it was fascinating to be able to actually read the transcriptions that Lois did of when different people were receiving different messages and the like. He talked about that he could, at any time after that faculty was developed, that he could bring it back if he would just be quiet. He called it the opposite of thinking. It was actually non-thinking, and that he could actually receive. He felt that he had mediumistic ability. And he was able to bring in material from the other side. He said, it has not only to do with the mystic world of the spirit of God himself, it also has to do with the world of spirits, people who have passed on and yet still live. Over great many years, I've had tremendous number of such experiences of all sorts and witnessed them widely in AA. And so, how is it that I define reality? What is it that I think that's right and what you should do or what you should do or what you shouldn't do? Where is it that I draw the line or where is it that I don't investigate? These guys didn't care. They were on the path. In 1943, for Smitty's anniversary, Bill wrote him a letter and said, "Hope you got the magic tray I sent you. And he sent him a Ouija board, and he and Ann and the group in Akron started using it. So Bill has this experience in Nantucket. I just love this. In 1947, Bill's up in Nantucket. He's hanging out. An AA friend has invited him over to stay, and he and Lois are there and some other friends. And Bill gets up early in the morning and has a cup of coffee, and all of a sudden there's an intrusion by they called them disincarnates, those without bodies. And this guy shows up in the kitchen. Bill's having his coffee, smoking a cigarette. And this apparition shows up, and he says, "I need to get a whaling ship. I need a job. Can you help me?" And Bill says, "Well, no, I can't." And he says, "Well, then I need a drink. Can you help me get a drink?" Bill says, "Well, I can't help you with that." He said, "Do you know that you're dead?" And this Norwegian guy goes, "Well, no." He said, "I was wondering why people aren't responding to me when I'm talking to them." And he goes, and Bill says, "You know, just relax." He said, "If you just relax, there'll be a lot of people who will be there to help you if you just, you know, open yourself up to the experience." And so this Norwegian guy says, "Thanks," and he leaves. And then suddenly this other guy shows up, and he goes to Bill. This guy's name was Shaw, and he said, "Great job. We've been trying to help this clown forever, and we're really glad you were able to. This will make things a lot easier for us." And so Shaw says to Bill, "Do you want to meet anybody else?" There's nobody else in the kitchen. Bill's smoking. "I'll have another cup of coffee." "Sure, bring some guys in." And so this guy Shaw brings some folks in, and there's this guy Pettingill, and there's a guy Quigley, who are both ship's captains, and then there's this guy David Morrow, who's died in this battle with Farragut and all this stuff, and they're all very interesting, and Bill has a great time, and then they leave. Bill's still in the kitchen smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee. The guy who owns the house comes down. They are all having breakfast. There's seven or eight people. And Bill starts telling the story of what happened, just to see. You know, now, Bill never talked about this with anybody. You got to remember that what I'm talking about are private letters, although this story is in conference-approved stuff. But people are just like, they're getting nervous. "Bill, don't you have to go back to New York? You know, this is really odd." And so, okay, so he just stopped. That day, they were going to have a picnic. And so they go into Nantucket to have a picnic, and there's a war memorial. And so they go around, and they're looking at the war memorial, and son of a gun, if there isn't the name David Morrow. And everybody kind of looks at Bill, and they look at that, and they go, well, that's just weird. You're psychic or something. You probably read about that someplace else. And Bill says, you know, come on. I wouldn't make this stuff up if I wanted to. I'm not that interested. Later on, they go over to the Whaling Museum, and in the Whaling Museum, in the old days, you used to be able to look through the captain's log, and who's there? Quigley, Pettingill. Now, in regards to all this spiritualist stuff, Dr. Bob and the gangs are having their own experience. Bob and Bill had very, very little correspondence between the two of them. There's maybe 60 letters total. But this is one where Bob's scolding Bill. He says, Bill, you haven't written me the letter like you said, so I'll keep on you until you write us to come down to see the antics of some of your psychic friends. My bump of curiosity is stimulated at the moment. Hope you like thy kingdom come. Let me know your reaction, especially to the general idea of the whole Brotherhood of Light. Maybe I'm a little bit moist, as in wet-brained, on the subject, but I feel rather not. I'll speak with you later. I'm reading a good deal about this in one book or another. So it's this thing of these guys are sharing this path and what it is that they're finding. Bill writes back and says, Dear Bob, much thank for those books. The second one's just come in. Lois and I had a great interest in reading it aloud to one another and are passing it around among our spooking friends, of which we are developing quite a few. He says later on that when they started to get some information about Lois's father, and she finally said, oh my goodness, this stuff's really going on. This is a fascinating book. A guy by the name of Arthur Ford. The book is called Nothing So Strange. And in it, if you want to read about how they did 12-step calls in the 50s, it's marvelous. In fact, Stan, it was probably what was going on with you. But Ford talks about, he was as a young man, he had this great mediumistic ability, and then he was in a bad car wreck, and he used morphine to deal with the pain. And then when he got off the morphine, they used alcohol, and he became a hopeless alcoholic. And Bill and the boys helped him get sober. And anyway, it's a really, really fun book. Art and Bill's relationship was such that Bill one day was walking through New York and he had this feeling that he was supposed to go to Ford's apartment. And when he did, he got there and Ford had a bleeding ulcer that had ruptured and he was dying. And he was able to get him to the hospital before he passed. So Arthur was always very close to Lois and the people in the office of New York. Now, again, this isn't just Bill and Bob being weird. This is the consciousness of the era. There are lots and lots of people that are doing this. This whole thing with Houdini busting mediums and all that kind of stuff. And Arthur Ford was the one who came up with the formula and reported it to Mrs. Houdini. This is a picture of Reverend Tunks. Arthur was visiting with Bill one day, and he said, I've got a message to you from Reverend Tunks, who passed away. And Bill went, no, I was just with him on Founders Day. He didn't die. He's around. And Ford gave him the message. Bill called, found out, indeed, Tunks had passed, and the information that he'd gotten was right. Frank Amos. Many of you know about Frank Amos. Frank Amos was the guy who Mr. Rockefeller sent out to Akron to make sure that the alcoholics were really not drinking. We need a report. We're sending Amos. Amos is a straight shooter. We need to know. And Amos came back with this glowing report that many of you have read. And anyway, Frank ended up retiring to Florida. And when he was there, he got involved with the spiritualist church, and he wrote Bill a letter saying that Dr. Bob is showing up occasionally. And Bill wrote back, and he said to Frank, when this year is finished with all its special events, 1960 was the convention out in Los Angeles, Lois and I hope to take a deeper interest in the psychic world. Now and then we go to Stanford with Ann and DeVoe, and Dr. Bob also turns up there now and then. It's wonderful that he is so much with you, and it's wonderful that he is so much with us. I like to call this part Medicine's Promise. Now, many of us have a nice relationship in Southern California with a guy by the name of Chuck C. I was fortunate to, the first 4 years that I was sober, that he was still around and talking, and I got to hear him talk. And this is an excerpt of a letter from Chuck. Bill and Chuck are good friends, and Bill confides one day in Chuck and with his problems. And Chuck writes back to him, and he says that Chuck says, now I'll slip the rug out from under you. What about it's not I but the Father within me that doeth the works? Of myself I am nothing. My health, my strength, my wisdom, my substance, my very life are the gift of God in whom we live and move and have our being. I know that you know all these things, Bill, but the trick is in acting as if they were true and proving them to be true. The truth that sets us free. No more paper, no more talk. Elsa joins me in sending all my love to you, all love to you. Now, I don't know how many of you have been around depressives. How many folks saw that documentary, the Bill W. documentary? It's a lovely, lovely piece of work. It really is. But in it, one of the things that they really talk about is Bill's depression. And here's Bill's response. Dear Chuck, thanks a lot for your thoughtful note. I hope your trips panned out to the great joy of everyone, as I'm sure they did. Now it looks as though I'll be on the coast again pretty soon. In the last line of your letter, you say, I know that you know all these things are true, but the trick is acting as if they were true. Well, Chuck, that's exactly the point. To make the job work, there must be conviction and the willingness and the will to act as if they are true. Some of us seem to lack the conviction or else the capability of acting so. If everybody could act or would act like this, we would certainly all be a lot better off. None is a better example than your own. And he goes on to say that if I have a bellyache next time, I surely will try to keep it to myself. Bill didn't have anybody that he could confide in once Bob had passed. In regards to his, just to give you kind of an idea of that, here's this guy, he's the point of contact for a worldwide movement. He's describing his depression to someone. And he says, I'm sure that the long continuance of this sort of anguish often gets you down, just as it did me. You may recall that from 1942 until 1955, I was never completely free from depression. In some years, this disability was of suicidal proportions, but the depression has ended. I haven't had one since 1955. These are two people. There's Abram Hoffer. How many people know Mildred who's not here? So, when Mildred tells her story about being in the nut ward, being with the psychiatrist and getting worse and worse and worse, this is the man who came in and said to her psychiatrist, this woman isn't crazy, she's alcoholic. So this is one of my favorite people on the planet, because Mildred's one. And they came up with a non-habit-forming natural substance called leucoandrenochrome. It was an effective anti-anxiety compound. And They met Bill socially, Dr. Abram Hoffer and Dr. Humphrey Osmond, and they turned Bill on to this stuff. They said, here, try this. And he experienced a relaxation that he'd never had. And he spent a lot of time trying to help these guys, and he did actually help them get it to Pfizer and help the product get to market. The problem was it was a natural substance, and they couldn't get it to be shelf-stable. But again, here's a man who's trying different things because he knows that there's lots of alcoholics from the letters that he's getting that are suffering from depression, and he'll do anything he can to help him. So he's being a guinea pig. He's trying different compounds of this stuff. And here's just a little something where Bill's describing what he was going through. Family problems, serious illness of friends, writing under forced draft, controversial meetings at the office, increased number of deadlines that must be met in the next 30 days. All this added up to a lot of pressure. On the 11th day, it forced me to bed. I took 2 Leuco in the morning. Combination of anxiety, frustration, and exhaustion completely stopped me. Tried some writing in bed, but had to quit. By mid-afternoon, felt almost hysterical. Could not eat. By 7 o'clock, things eased. I had a little. I had a good meal and slept pretty late. I rose jittery, rebellious at the demands of many people for attention. Still another problem case coming to the house this evening. Looking toward future commitment makes me want to run up to the country indefinitely, knowing that I can't gives me the rather and familiar sensation of being trapped for the rest of my life. Not much real depression, however. And yet he continued to stay the course. Bill got all kinds of letters. You know, this is kind of pre-Al-Anon stuff. One from was a woman who was talking about her husband's experience with Dexamil. Bill says, personally, I'm not too familiar with Dexamil. But as far as the addiction, this is a pretty natural course for us people to take. But as addicts, we simply can't use these new drugs. Stimulants, tranquilizers, and sedatives. They become addictions in themselves, even far worse than alcohol in many cases. Did he say, but as addicts, we simply can't use these? Oh, anyway. Now again, I hope you see that I'm an AA guy. I'm totally down with singleness of purpose. And this was a private letter. So it's not him making some pronouncement, because Narcotics Anonymous had already been launched and was helping save lives. This is Lucille Kahn. And Lucille Kahn and her husband David were great supporters of... and she was part of the Psychic Research Institute in New York. And she was inviting Bill to come and give a talk on psychedelics and psychic phenomenon. She says, I read Aldous Huxley's latest essay on expanded consciousness, and I realized that the subject is occupying more and more the reflection of serious thinkers. That there is a possibility of an illuminated moment without leading a monastic life. All of which brings to me our discussion of last year when you were kind enough to come and stand by in the event that one of our speakers didn't show. This is the book Heaven and Hell, and it's about the nature of consciousness and intuition. And its starting point is about using mescaline. And Bill, in a letter to a friend, says, though you may gag on the use of mescaline, you'll probably get a lot of ideas about the basis of intuition and mystical insight. Bill wrote to his friend Gerald Hurd, and he said that he and Lois had read Heaven and Hell and that it mirrored their experience exactly. And this was before Bill ever got involved in using psychedelics to see if they would be helpful to alcoholics. Now, when I speak of Bill using LSD, remember three things. Number one, This is medicine. This is not about getting high at all. This is medically supervised. This is not about climbing into a closet with the headphones on and a bottle of Spinata. This is medicine, this is research, this is exploration, and these gentlemen that I spoke about, Dr. Hoffman, or Hoffer and Dr. Osmond, they ran a hospital, a psychiatric hospital for schizophrenics in Saskatchewan, Canada. And one of the things that they did was they treated street drunks, people that could not be helped by Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill, in fact, at one point says, we maybe get about 5% of these people to actually get sober. So they recommend that Bill, they're starting to have this incredible success with people staying sober because they're introduced to a mystical experience in a therapeutic setting in an environment where they're encouraged. And they start talking to Bill about it, and he said, before taking LSD, the very thought that three little pills might produce an experience was revolting. If anybody says that biochemistry has any connection with spiritual insight, he's in for a bad time. With them, contempt prior to investigation will be the rule. Nor will they investigate. They will only yell. And he goes on to talk about that the numbers seem to be what it was that they were finding was is that a third of the patients that they gave this to had a tremendous result. A third, it was kind of good, and a third didn't have any result at all. So what does Bill do? He goes to Santa Monica. He has an experience with Dr. Cohn, and in that experience, what happens is he says that his town's experience was confirmed to him. And he says, this is a good thing. This can help alcoholics that AA can't help. It can help them bridge that gap. And so what does Bill do? He comes back and does exactly what he did with the spook group. They start this LSD group. And in it, it was always medically supervised. And there are many of the same people. And what they're doing is they're exploring the frontiers of consciousness. Now, in these tests, people will say, well, Bill did LSD at least 150 times over a 5-year period. The nature of these tests, the way they were done, was that there would be 8 people. Only 2 would take the substance, and the other 6 would help guide these people through their experience. And so just because somebody, Sam Shoemaker showed up at a couple of these sessions, so did Ed Dowling. Lois actually had some in Saskatchewan once. So, I mean, this is not, again, and there were lots of different people that were vibrant and like the Luces in politics and publishing and art in New York that were involved in this stuff. So again, this is not people getting loaded. These are people looking for a solution to alcoholism and to see the frontiers of their own being. Bill talks about Dr. Cohn and Dr. Dittman, the people who helped him who guided him through his first experience. And he said that when they looked at him, they looked at me like a butterfly stuck on a pin. I was just a case, but last summer they came to our house at Bedford Hills. If ever there was a changed man, it was the same Dittman. He'd taken the material 2 or 3 times and could not deny the objective reality of what he had seen, though he made every effort to dislodge the notion. And then what does Bill do? He says, I got out James's Varieties of Religious Experience and read him selected mystical passages. Sidney Cohen, the other California psychiatrist, was there too. When they heard the experiences read from James and thought of the over 400 people to whom they had given the drug, they were able to say that many of the experiences out of the book had been reproduced in their patients. In a letter that Bill wrote to Carl Jung, he says that over the past 3 years, 150 cases have been so treated by my Canadian friends. As of this writing, 75 are remaining perfectly sober in the outside world. And lastly, I'd like to talk a little bit about the personal philosophy, about what it is that these guys were doing. Yeah, Bill, in one letter to a friend, he's talking about the 12 and 12, why he wrote it. He said, "I wrote the second book because people were treating the first like holy writ. And now they've started to do it with this book. What can I do to stop them?" Bill had the vision that alcoholism was not just a problem for the U.S., that it was a worldwide problem, and he did everything he could to help people not get stuck in just there being one type of religious solution. He said, "We already know as a fact that some theological propositions are tremendous obstacles to place in the way of atheist or agnostic drunks." Anybody was like that when they came in? I think it was certainly Christian in spirit of us to feel that such people ought to have their chance as well as those who believe in the entirety of the Christian doctrine. He says, "Alcoholism is not confined to Christians. We've made a promising beginning in the Buddhist world. Suppose this movement carried the Christian label. It is relevant to ask oneself how far we could get with them in such cases." Bill, talking to a friend, he says that if he had the time, that what he would do is that he would work on a restatement of theology, one not based in old types of religion, informed from the experiences that he got from members of Alcoholics Anonymous. This afternoon, I was looking through a stack of letters about this thick at our general service office that were about AA's reporting their own personal spiritual awakenings to Bill. It's fascinating stuff. And he says that, "I'm deeply ashamed to say that I've never read the Old Testament to any extent at all. Respecting the new, I'm only a little less ignorant. When it comes to the sense and nonsense of Christianity, I'm the merest nonsense. But I do feel that the world needs a restatement of theology, at least one that convincingly explains who man is, what this sojourn is all about, where he goes next, if any place, and what his ultimate destiny may be. There may be some answers in the exploration of psychic phenomenon and the mystic experience. So I find that I keep poking around in these areas, hoping to contribute a little someday. But that day seems a long way off. Since AA came of age and I retired, I've never had so many distractions since the old AA juggernaut started rolling along." Bill actually believed that when he retired from Alcoholics Anonymous, what he and Lewis would be involved in doing is studying the evolution of what happens with the spirit after the apparent death of the body. He called it survival, that's what the spiritualists called it in those days. And his personal experiences with this stuff is fascinating, and if you're interested, he was talking to a guy, Ed Kapling, or Ed C., who was suffering greatly, and he said, "I only wish I had the opportunity of sharing this vast and tremendous experience which I have had and have witnessed with you." He said, "The next best thing I can do is send you this book, and this book is called The Imprisoned Splendor, and it's by Raynor Johnson, R-A-Y-N-O-R. And it is, Bill said that this book describes what I have seen and witnessed better than anything else. First half of it, Johnson's a physicist. The second half is about the nature of the mystical experience and how they merge. And again, if you've seen the movie What the Bleep Do We Know, all of this stuff is very contemporary. And Bill's investigating this stuff 40, 50 years ago. The last thing I'd like to share with you is to bring Bob back into us, is this thing about the Akron pamphlets. The Akron pamphlets were written because Dr. Bob believed that the Big Book was written at too high an education level for the normal working guy. And one of the pamphlets is called Spiritual Milestones in Alcoholics Anonymous. And in it, this book, this stuff, he had his friend write the stuff. This is Bob and a couple of the old-timers. This is what they're thinking. They say, consider the eight-part program laid down in Buddhism. Right view, right aim, right speech, right living, right action, right effort, right mindedness, and right contemplation. The Buddhist philosophy, as exemplified by these 8 points, could literally be adopted by AA as a substitute for or an addition to the 12 steps? Now, I don't know what I would have said if somebody had gotten up in my home group and said that. This is coming from Akron in 1940. This is coming from what supposedly was the hotbed of rigidity. How is it that I can support my own journey and those of others? And lastly, Bill talks that AA is liable to be deformed and perverted by the will to more and more concentrate power in its patriarchs. I think AA can avoid this temptation, and I truly believe that it's going to be intelligent enough and spiritual enough to get accurate guidance from God as to what it should do and how it should behave. Us AAs, I'm sure, can rely upon our group conscience. This is the fruit of the General Service Conference. And are we making sure that our very best members, our brightest members, are the people that are getting involved in General Service now? Because the movement needs our very best now. Just an opinion. And here's a letter that Bill, in 1962, he's writing to the same Roland Jay that was working with Bob back in Akron. By this time, Roland's working with Glenn Clark in the Camp Farthest Out movement. And he says that at this stage, dependence should be upon God and not upon AA elders. That was why he wanted to retire. I mean, think of it. This man that we ascribe all this power driving to, literally, aside from George Washington and Krishnamurti, I don't know of any other people that actually walked away from the thing, or, you know, while it was rolling and while they had all the power. This is my favorite picture of Dr. Bob. He's an intern at the hospital. And Bill says, in talking to his cousin, Jean Kalkoff, she said, well, it's a lot of fun trying to figure it all out. That is, if you don't take yourself too seriously. In describing recovery from alcoholism, Dr. Jung said that it's very interesting that in Latin, the same word is used for the highest religious state and the most depraving poison, being alcohol. He said, therefore, the helpful formula is spiritus, the spirit of God, contra spiritum, against the power of alcohol. Thank you very much.